Hello, and welcome to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry Kaufman, where we give you insights into the mind, brain, behavior, and creativity. Each episode will feature a new guest who will stimulate your mind and give you a greater understanding of yourself, others, and the world we live in. Hopefully, we'll also provide a glimpse into human possibility. Thanks for listening and enjoy the podcast. Today, it's great to have Dr. Eric Turkheimer on the podcast. Dr. Turkheimer is the Hugh Scott Hamilton Professor of Psychology at the University of Virginia. His lab studies how interactions between genes and environments shape the development of human behavior. Today, we'll be focusing mostly on Turkheimer's research on intelligence, genetics, and family background. The topic of intelligence is a favorite here at the Psychology Podcast. Some of our previous guests discussing this topic include Christopher Chabri and Stuart Ritchie. I personally have studied this topic since the beginning of my career, so I'm always eager to engage in respectful, mature discussion on the topic. If you'd like to join in the discussion, please go to thepsychologypodcast.com and leave comments on the post for this episode. Eric, great to have you on the show today.
Nice to see you, Scott.
Let's jump right into this. What is intelligence? How do you define it? What's your personal conceptualization?
I think intelligence is the ability to process information and solve problems. I mean, that's pretty basic, I guess. I mean, there's more technical definition of intelligence, of course. Mm-hmm. But I don't know. I guess I think that's a pretty good starting place.
Okay. And then there's two issues. There's a question of a definition, and there's the issue of measurement. Mm-hmm. Now, what do you think are some of the best measures of what you just defined that are out there right now?
Well, I don't know. I don't know what you mean specifically, but there's, of course, an entire universe of intelligence tests, IQ tests, so-called, of various different kinds. And those range from formal IQ tests that you might take with a professional psychologist to, in my opinion, things like the SATs that you take in high school are more or less a kind of intelligence test. They're formulated and conceptualized a little bit differently.
So it sounds like you're saying IQ test. That's the answer.
Yeah.
It sounds like you're saying.
Yes.
Because one could say that it's, you know, that IQ is a very limited measure of intelligence, and there's been arguments in that effect, and et cetera. So I just want to make sure that we're on the same page, that everyone understands exactly what you're saying at every step of this way.
Yeah. And I think if this is where you're headed, that some of the more general things that people sometimes talk about as intelligence, social intelligence, and interpersonal intelligence, and emotional intelligence. Those are all really important things in the world. But I guess I do think of those as separate from what I think of as intelligence per se, which is more about problem solving specifically than it is about the kind of much broader activities that people have to conduct in the world.
Yeah, sure. But, you know, so one could make the argument that certain kinds of problem solving are very contextual based on domain specific areas of human adaptation throughout the course of human evolution. So it sounds like when you say problem solving, you're talking about a general problem solving ability that's captured by, well, we can talk about the G factor. We can talk about the G factor if you want.
Yeah, we should talk about the G factor because I have fairly particular ideas about the G factor that maybe aren't necessarily the same as other people you might talk to about it.
Great. I'd love to hear what your thoughts are on the G factor. And you can understand why I want to make sure we clarify how you think about intelligence and how you think we should measure it. Because, you know, there is no objective, you know, 10 commandments that God gave us saying this is the measure of intelligence and this is how we should define. So, you know, that's why it's very important for people to clarify their terms. So tell me what the G factor is.
Well, I mean, what the G factor definitely is, I mean, and I think the question is whether it's more than this, but what it, I think it indisputably is a statistical construct that describes the fact that ability tests, very broadly, ability tests are positively correlated with each other. And people who do well on one ability test tend to do well on other ability tests. People often speak as though the positive correlations among ability tests mean that there is only one kind of intelligence that explains all of why tests go together. And I don't think that's the case, even though it's the case that the correlations among different ability tests are positive. But in any event, as a statistical matter, anytime you have a number of tests that are positively correlated with each other, it's possible in a statistical way to extract from that matrix of tests something that's called a first principle component, which describes the way that those tests correlate together. And that literally is what general intelligence, or G, is. It's the first principle component of a matrix of positively correlated intelligence tests. Now, at that point, I think there comes a theoretical fork in the road in the history of thinking about intelligence, that one school of thought about intelligence, and I think probably it's safe to say the dominant school of thought about intelligence that goes back to Charles Spearman, says that this G, this statistical G thing that describes the positive correlation among a whole bunch of ability tests, must represent some kind of actual thing inside human beings that causes those tests to go together. Something in our brain that represents G, something in our genes that represent G. I don't agree with that conclusion. I think it's much better to think of G as a descriptive thing rather than a causal thing. G is a way of describing the way mental tests go together. It's not a way of explaining why mental tests go together.
Beautiful. That is in line with a lot of recent research on statistical modeling of G, showing that it's a better model to look at G as a reflective variable, you know, in a structural equation model, as sort of the emergent property of multiple indicators of cognitive ability as opposed to the causal force. So even from like a, so from a statistical model and then from a brain model.
You mean kind of network theory, kind of?
Oh, you know, I'm referring to recent statistical models of G that have tried to model it as either a causal force or an outcome, you know, and research shows that it does make more sense to think of it. You said descriptive, and that's exactly what the research suggests is a better way of thinking. It's as an emergence, you know, it's not a thing. It's an emergent property. And also, that seems in line with the recent research on G not making any sense as existing in an individual brain. It has to do with individual differences. You know, even Arthur Jensen, who a lot of people malign, or, you know, who's done a lot of good scientific work on this topic, and we can get to some of his more controversial stuff later, but he has done some significant scientific work. You know, he made the case that G intelligence has no meaning if you're the only one on a desert island. If you can't compare your G level to anyone else on that island, it makes no sense to, you can't measure your G. So all that, I just want to say, is consistent with what you just said.
Yeah. And I think to get back, I think I placed a marker on something while we were getting to where we are about the unidimensionality of G and intelligence, because I think that's very important. That, you know, going back to Charles Spearman, who came up with this idea in the first place, people have asked what's, again, a statistical question about whether all of the various covariation among the infinite number of mental tests that you could give to people can be fit by a single common factor. And the answer to that question, going back to Spearman, is no. In fact, as domains of tests go, it's true that intelligence is fairly well described by a single factor, more than, say, personality or something. But Spearman himself showed that G per se, one single factor, was not enough. And I think people, well, it's two things. People, it can be very easy to think that because all tests are positively correlated with each other, that means that there must only be one thing that's causing them. And that, as a statistical matter, is not the case. And second, once you come up with this statistical thing called G and describe it mathematically and name it as G, it's very easy to fall in love with it a little bit and think that, well, now that we have this thing called G, and it does describe quite a bit of the variation in intelligence, that it must be the single one and only thing. And the whole domain of describing something as complicated as intelligence with latent factors like G gets way more complicated as soon as you have more than one factor to work with.
Great points. You know, I really like the Johnson and Bouchard model that has really done some systematic analyses of the fundamental group factors of G and shown in verbal, nonverbal, and spatial are some pretty essential group factors. Yeah, so one can reduce all these different cognitive ability tests to a single dimension, and one can do that, and that does have predictive value. Something my mentor, I did my master's degree with Nicholas McIntosh at Cambridge, who I think wrote the best textbook on this topic. And, you know, he constantly has made that point that, you know, this positive manifold doesn't stop with cognitive ability. There are a whole nexus of socioeconomic status. I mean, this nomological network of G is very broad. And one thing that is difficult to do is disentangle, you know, all of these causal forces and disentangle which is causing what, you know, within this nomological network. So that's no easy feat, is it?
No. Mm-mm. That's right. And yeah, and one school of thought that I'm sure we'll get into is to sort of take G and put it at the center of that universe and say that everything else that happened is caused by this G thing, rather than seeing G as part of a much broader descriptive network.
Good.
And, you know, one analogy that I've been kicking around some is with the idea of health. Let's say you took a whole bunch of medical measurements from people. You got their blood pressure and their BMI and their lung capacity and how fast they could run and all those various things, and got correlations among all those things. They would be, I would imagine, positively correlated. Maybe not quite as positively correlated as mental tests are, but you'd still be able to take a first principle component out of them that describes the way all these various health measures go together, and you can call it health. And some people at any given moment are healthier than other people. We're very accustomed to talking about it this way. And on surveys, you ask people a single question, you know, how would you describe your health on a scale from 1 to 10? But it wouldn't occur to us to think of health as this special inner quality that people carry around. And it wouldn't occur to us to start looking for the health center in people's brain body, or start to ask, well, what are the specific genes that cause people to be healthier than each other? We recognize health as just what you say. Health is a way of describing a certain domain of covariation in a very complicated network of things, but it's not a cause of those things, it's a description of those things.
I love that. And that also, taking that analogy, it seems like it would be incredibly uncompassionate and immoral to apply that same argument to, say, you know, the cognitive elite argument, but we make the health elite argument and say, you know, if you take the same logic and say people who are low SES are doomed to be low SES because they have low health. Well, so therefore we should give all interventions to help people be healthy. I mean, it's not just politically correct thing to say. It's called like just being a fundamentally having humanity.
And it misses that health is at least as much an effect as it is a cause.
Absolutely. Okay, I'd really like to transition here to the question of, is IQ heritable? And when you're answering this question, you know, when you define what heritability means, if you could please add some caveats and nuance that often gets missed in that answer, to the effect where you let people know that heritability has nothing to do with modifiability.
Okay. Well, yes. I mean, the simple answer to the question is that IQ is heritable. And I mean, as good a description of my career as any is, it's been about understanding the complications of saying that some kind of individual difference like intelligence is heritable. I mean, that's what I do. And first, my preferred way of saying what it means for something to be heritable right now is this, that there is a correlation between how genetically similar any two people are and how similar their intelligence is, right? So you can think of that. I mean, the classic way to think about that is in terms of identical and fraternal twins. And pairs of identical twins are more similar than pairs of fraternal twins. And the IQs of identical twins are more similar than the IQs of fraternal twins. You can do it with other kinds of, or you can do it with siblings and half siblings, the same thing. And nowadays, you can do it with pairs of people who aren't related, just in terms, because we can now calculate how much DNA any particular pair of people share, and you get technically different but more or less similar answers when you do it that way. And so that's what it is. It's a correlation between genetic similarity and similarity in whatever it is that you're interested in. And as such, it doesn't show that there are genes for anything in particular. It doesn't really tell you anything about why it's the case that more genetically similar people are more similar for whatever. I'm trying to avoid using the word phenotype here, which is just a technical word for the observable ways that people are similar. That's one thing. The other thing that you have to think about, I'll get to malleability in a second. The other thing that you have to think about when you think about the heritability of intelligence is that's not something interesting and special about intelligence. That, wow, how do you like that? It turns out that intelligence is heritable. Everything about human beings is heritable. Any difference among human beings that you can measure is heritable. So your personality is heritable. Your risk of having a mental disease is heritable. And then you can get past things like that. How much television you watch is heritable. How liberal and conservative you are is heritable. Everything about people is heritable. And all that means is that, in general, people who are more genetically similar are more similar, whatever. That as we go through the course of our lives becoming whatever it is that we become, I think of it as our genes have their finger on the scales, and they are always nudging us in one direction or another, so that wherever we come out, well, our genes had a little bit to do with how we got there. So it's not a specific characteristic of any one thing. One more before I get to malleability. The next thing is that now in the last 15 or 20 years, that we can study these things not just with identical and fraternal twins or parents and children and stuff like that, but with actual measured DNA, biological DNA that we get out of our bodies, we have made the amazing discovery that for something like intelligence that's heritable, there are a lot to be said about this, but in a simple sense, there are no genes for any of these things. There is no gene that in a known biological way causes people to be smarter. There are genes that in a known biological way cause people to be less intelligent because it gives them major diseases. But leaving that aside, there are no big genes for intelligence. You could say there's a lot of little genes, but I think even that is too strong. So anyway, the genetics of intelligence exists in this matrix of everything being intelligent, and that our genes, like your grandmother said, that the apple doesn't fall far from the tree, that our genes in very general ways influence everything we become. Because it's so general, doesn't have a lot of implications ultimately for the way we think about ourselves. I think most of us always knew that our genes placed a certain amount of constraint on what was likely to happen to us. And it seems surprising the first time you hear it. Once you stop and think about it, I don't really think it's so surprising at all. So anyway, malleability. I think the first time you think about something being heritable, and the first time you think about your genes having some kind of input into an outcome, it's natural to think of it as, well, this is an aspect of us that's more fixed than we had thought that it might be otherwise. Well, I thought that my intelligence was just the result of my hard work or how my parents raised me or how good my school is. Well, it turns out it's in my genes. There's not that much we can do about it. And that is formally, mathematically, biologically not the case. The two things, they don't really have a whole lot to do with each other. There are a whole lot of very standard examples that I didn't think up about it. One good one is height. Height is an obviously heritable thing, and nobody is surprised to hear that height is heritable. And we don't, in fact, even think of ourselves as being able to do anything to control our height. But the fact is, the height of various populations of people has changed enormously in a very short period of time. Japanese people now are about 5 inches taller than they were before World War II. That's not a genetic change. Height was very heritable before World War II, very heritable after World War II, and height has increased an enormous amount in Japan over that time. You can tell the same story in an interesting way with Dutch people. Before World War II, Americans were on average several inches taller than the Dutch. They're now several inches taller than us. It was heritable then, it's heritable now. There's been a big change. One more example, a slightly different one that gets at it from a slightly different angle, is a disease called phenylketonuria. Phenylketonuria is a metabolic disease that, unlike everything else we've been talking about, is controlled by a single dominant gene. It's not like all these complex things like intelligence and height. There is a gene for phenylketonuria. If you have the dominant gene, you're unable to metabolize a naturally existing chemical called phenylalanine that exists in food. And if you eat foods with phenylalanine, it poisons you and causes severe mental retardation and eventually death. So that's it's a genetic disorder in a straightforward way. However, it turns out that if you avoid foods with phenylalanine, everything's fine. You know, so it's a genetically caused disorder, and the treatment for it is entirely environmental.
Good. You said a lot of really interesting things that I hope clarify. So I want to further clarify something. So this July, behavior geneticists will announce over 600 SNPs statistically associated with educational attainment, which we know is correlated with IQ. Let's do the Thar experiment. Even if it comes back and says 100% of individual differences in educational attainment is explained by the combination of 600 small SNPs, that still wouldn't mean that the environment couldn't influence an outcome. Is that correct?
Yep, absolutely.
So I think a lot of people aren't aware of that. And not only not aware of that, but a lot of my listeners are like, what the heck's an SNP? You could explain that a little bit?
Well, it's literally something called single nucleotide polymorphism. I usually just refer to it as a SNP. I think that's usually the way people say it. A SNP is a single unit of DNA, in the ACGT sequence that makes up chromosomes, and genes are long strings of ACGT. There are certain particular locations that only take one of two values, ACGT. Those are referred to as SNPs. And I'm not, frankly, very good at the biological technical side, so I hope I don't get any of this wrong. But we are now able to put, I think, 2 million tests for those SNPs on a single chip, a SNP chip, and determine which of the two a particular individual has. And there have been very, very, very elaborate detailed maps that allow us to go from which particular values of SNPs you have at different locations on your chromosome and how that maps on to what genes you're carrying. So the sort of current state of the art in gene hunting is to do the hunting at the level of SNPs. And simply, it's a very simple process of looking for individual paired SNPs, and where one value seems to be associated with having higher educational attainment than another value. And then there's inferential work can be done on top of that to try and identify genes, though that starts to get very, very complicated. And that there's, I think, one other important thing to say about this overall process, by the way, I don't think you used this, is called GWAS, or
Genome-Wide Association Study.
Is this process of searching for SNPs associated with them. And so we're now doing this process for all of the many human traits that we discovered were heritable 50 years ago using twins and siblings and adoptees and all that kind of stuff. And it's interesting that we're able to do this now. And it may well turn out as time goes by that we learn important things from doing this, but it's not surprising for all these heritable traits that we're able to find SNPs that are associated with them. Once we knew that intelligence was heritable, another way of saying that is to say, well, there are differences in DNA that are associated with intelligence. We knew that was true. And so a lot of modern SNP finding, from my point of view, is a matter of confirming what we already knew. It's finding out the same things about heritability that we already knew from twins and siblings and families. I think there's a tendency to sometimes that even now that people have gotten used to the idea that behavior is broadly heritable, to make the same mistake you were suggesting of thinking, wow, now that we're finding out that there are actual little bits of DNA that are associated with these behaviors, that must really be fixing it. You know, we're really finding the education genes, or more commonly, the IQ genes here. And I personally don't really think we are. I think it's safe to say the jury is still out. And I think there are a lot of people who think that at least we're at the beginning of a road that's going to end up with a actual genetic biological understanding of something like educational attainment. I myself am quite a bit more skeptical.
But you could never do without the socialization process in this. No matter what is found, if you want to increase educational achievement, even if it turns out that some people have greater genetic potential for the ultimate heights of learning and rate of learning, et cetera, that still doesn't mean that we should provide the most challenging opportunities for everyone, right?
Oh, of course not.
So I think that kind of gets missed sometimes in these discussions. Is, you know, we can get so lost in the weeds that so like, so what? You know, or like, you know, what's the practical implication here? Now, some people have written some thoughtful books about how genetically informed understanding of school could lead us to teach and individualize learning for different people, et cetera, et cetera. And I think there are some thoughtful things out there about that, but it still doesn't get rid of the teaching part.
No, of course not.
I know you say of course not, but I do think that is missed in some of these.
Well, yes, no, and no, I mean, I say of course not by way of agreeing with you, but it's an incredibly difficult and complicated problem. I mean, I've spent my entire professional life trying to think about exactly what it means that our genes might be related to how much education people wind up obtaining. And, you know, if you put me on the spot and say, okay, you've got 3 minutes, explain exactly how that works, I'm not sure I could do it. And it's a very, very deep and difficult theoretical problem. When you have a problem like that, I think what happens is that the two poles of the problem, the two easy ends of it, become magnets for people. And you find people saying, oh, well, yeah, we got the genes, you know, and people are just born that way. And right, some people are born smarter than others. And then you have people on the other side saying, how could you say such a thing that the genes have something to do with educational attainment, that that's determinism and et cetera, et cetera, et cetera, and want to argue that genes must have nothing to do with it. And neither of those two poles is ever a good answer.
Good. I would not want it to be the case that our intelligence was 100% determined by either the environment or 100% determined by our genes. Either situation would really suck if you think about it, right? I mean, then you would have no free will either way. Kind of, but people don't realize is that the way the reality of the world is actually pretty neat in a way. There is something that it means to be you, but there's also a lot that you can do to construct yourself and become who you consciously want to be. And also, I want to say I abhor the process of the idea that someday we'll be able to, as early as possible, measure people's genes and then use that as a forecasting utility value to differentiate people into different tracks as early as possible based on their genetics. Now, I really, really do not advocate for that.
I agree with you.
Yeah. Not just from like there's a moral standpoint, but just from like a human potential standpoint, I'm not convinced that doing that would maximize.
Yeah, it would be. I mean, the fact is, people think of it as something we could do off in some science fiction future, but the fact is we could do it today. And thinking about how we could do it today shows, I think, why it's morally wrong. Here's how you predict kids' school performance from their genes. You look up their parents' IQ scores. And parents' IQ scores are really powerful predictors of children's IQ scores. I mean, really much, much, much better than anything we could do with genomic information. And much of the reason for why parents' IQ scores predict kids' IQ scores are genetic. So why not just say, well, we should take parents who are really smart, right, and give the best resources to their children because they have the best genetic potential? You can't do that because people have a right to make the best of what they are regardless of your judgment of what their genetic potential is.
I couldn't agree more. maybe, I don't know if this is playing devil's advocate a little bit, but I want to ask you a question I just thought of. It seems, so if we are agreed that the heritability coefficient of a particular population, and by the way, heritability is a population variable, related variable, and it has to do with individual differences. There's no such thing as a heritability within a person, just like there's no such thing as an IQ within a person.
And it also means that, for me, the question, what's the heritability of intelligence, is a really bad question. Intelligence doesn't have a heritability that's like a property of it that it carries around from place to place. The heritability of intelligence depends on the particulars of the situation in which, of the population in which that intelligence is measured.
Absolutely. So that's one part of it. But so if we can agree that heritability is not a good proxy for the ability to change, then you've done research, very interesting research, showing that heritability coefficients are not the same magnitude across social classes. Now, even if that is true, and I'm kind of playing devil's advocate for a second, even if that is true, and we already just concluded that heritability is not a good proxy for the ability to change, then what's even the practical implication of your own findings in that regard? Do you know what I'm saying?
Yes, it's funny. I mean, if I'm honest, as somebody who's sometimes critical of people obsessing about what the heritability of this or that is, I do think it's hard to say exactly what it means that the heritability of intelligence, which is what that research is about, is different in some places than others. But I do think you can put meat on the bones of that finding. And the finding is that the heritability of intelligence, and I should add, it seems like it's in the United States, is lower in poor people than it is in well-off people, middle class and better people. Doesn't seem like that happens in Europe, which is the main other place that's been studied, probably because there's less economic inequality there, and especially educational inequality. And I frankly can't prove this. I think this is informed speculation about what that might mean. It's a variant on a standard example for thinking about genetic differences. Suppose you have a bunch of seeds that are varied genetically for how tall plants are going to be, and you plant them in really excellent soil. And some plants wind up taller than others, and that they're all in the same soil, the same good soil, and some wind up taller than others, and that's genetic variation in the seeds. You then take the same handful of seeds or another handful out of the same population and plant them in sand. Well, two things are going to happen. First of all, they're all going to be shorter. We all know that. But they're also going to be less varied because they're all going to be stunted. Even the seeds that had the genetic potential to produce tall plants in the good soil are going to wind up stunted. And of course, if the soil is bad enough, they're not going to grow at all. So it makes sense that individuals need a reasonably supportive environment in order to express their genetic variability. And if people are in an environment that doesn't permit them to seek out the environments that they can use to support, as you said, who they're going to become, mm-hmm. well, then that's going to cut down on the variability. And with heritability is a way of describing variability. So, you know, I think that's what's going on, that you can take a kid who has the potential to be a genius and raise that kid in an environment with an indifferent family and crummy schools and a terrible neighborhood, and that kid is not going to be able to find the resources to help him or her become really, really smart. And so it's a leveler.
Well, I see the rest of this podcast, let's talk about the most controversial topics, because I think that's, it feels right to transition into those now. So when we talk about SES difference, the cause of SES differences, in this idea, you know, Charles Murray has this idea of the cognitive elite as kind of being a reason. Now, it's a reasonable thing to say that there are IQ differences between different SES groups. Just to say that is reasonable. But to me, it seems to ignore all, it kind of puts too much focus on this one variable. You know, when there are so many other variables, one could pick any one variable and write a whole book about it.
And it assigns the key causal role to that variable.
Correct.
It doesn't see intelligence as part of the network of good things that happen to people when they're in a successful society and have resources. It sees them as the cause for why they're in that position in the first place. And, you know, it brings us back to just everything we were talking about at the beginning, that if G is this property that exists inside people and causes them to express all those good things that happen to them, that's the bell curve, basically. And like you say, I mean, it's not a, I don't think that's a crazy idea or a evil idea particularly. I just think it's wrong. I just think it mischaracterizes the role that intelligence actually plays in life. It's not the inner causal agent that causes any more than health is. To say, you know, like you say, you could talk about there's a health elite.
Right. Not even health. We could add to this list any trait. We could say aggression. Let's take aggression. I've seen some fabulous research come out recently by Daniel Nettle and others from an evolutionary point of view showing just minor social economic changes you make that reduce the aggression level significantly. Now, in some studies, I've seen the aggression levels reduced so much that there's no difference anymore between low SES and high SES once you make some minor system-wide tweaks to a really unstable and harsh environment that people are living in. So one could make the argument they are the way they are because they have low impulsivity, because they have aggression. But if you instead view it as this model we're talking about, as these are all outcome indicators, kind of barometer, a barometer of what environmental experiences interacting with genes that we all have, that any of us could become in a way with certain environmental conditions, that's a different way of thinking about it, right?
Yeah. It's a much more complex way of thinking about it. And it doesn't locate all the causation in one particular variable.
So let's go to the most controversial topic. Let's go right there. Okay, race differences in IQ. Now, look, again, it is not an unreasonable thing to say that there are race differences in average IQ scores between whites and blacks.
It's an that's just an observation.
A fact. And that gap has not seemed to narrow in the past 25 years. Okay.
I think it's narrowed.
A little bit.
It's not a topic I'm an expert on, but some of my common co-authors, Jim Flynn, Dick Nisbet, Bill Dickens, who know more about that than I do, I think argue very persuasively that it's down by a third over the last 34 years.
Okay. So it's down, but there still exists.
That's gone away.
It hasn't gone away. Okay. Now, then there's the other question. What are the causal forces? Just, we had this same discussion about SES, Lyle, and let's, you know, we could talk about group. Okay. The thing about this issue is that, okay, so first of all, we know that just because IQ is heritable, there's nothing in what we learn about the heritability of IQ that can be directly applied to understanding whether or not genes explain the difference between blacks and whites. So we can have a whole discussion, as we are having on this podcast, agreeing that, yes, there is a genetic contribution to individual differences in IQ in the general population, and that doesn't have anything to say about whether or not, to the extent to which genes explain differences between different groups. Now, do we agree on that as well?
Absolutely.
So here's a question I have. Is race a social construction? Does it make sense even in the first place to look for genetic, environmental factors that explain differences between whites and blacks in America?
Well, I mean, I'm not sure I have the same. You asked two questions, and I'm not sure I have the same answer to both of them. The first was, is race a social construction? And the second, does it make sense to talk about genetic environmental factors?
Oh, great point, because one could be yes, and the other one can be yes as well.
I'm a moderate sort of on that whole social construction business. And in some funny way, that's a question that people have argued about for so long, and it doesn't really seem very complicated to me in a way. There are a lot of things that we know are true. The human evolutionary story is a real thing, and we know a lot about where human beings came from and how they came out of Africa and how they spread around the globe over a very, very long evolutionary time span. It's also the case that in more recent times, people who live together in certain parts of the world are more genetically related to each other. People who live in Lithuania and think of themselves as Lithuanians are more like each other than they are like Japanese people who are like each other. And so it's not like the difference between Japanese people and Lithuanians is this imaginary social thing that we made up. There's biological reality. But the evolutionary story and the geographical sorting of people around the world is, by and large, continuous and dynamic. There aren't bright lines dividing groups of people, Lithuanians from Slavs, from those lines that we impose on that biological reality are, yes, socially constructed. And now, does that make them wrong? No. Does it make them useless? No. It makes them artificial boundaries that we impose on a very complex biological reality. So one more example, just to make the point that I was just thinking about. It's a kind of a trivial example, but I think it gets the point. Ski slopes are very complicated things. They differ in slope. They differ in how many moguls they have. They differ in how long they are. They differ in how narrow they are. All sorts of things. And there are all sorts of ways we could think about the difficulty of ski slopes. But what do? We come up with yellow, blue, and black. And we classify ski slopes as though there were just three kinds, yellow, blue, and black. Now, if we ask, are there really three kinds of ski slopes in the world and only three kinds of ski slopes? Of course not, right? Ski slopes are much more complicated than that. But sometimes, under some circumstances, it's useful to break them up in those groups as long as we remember that the three part and the exact borderline between yellow and blue is not given by nature. That's something that we do. So that's the answer to that, a too long answer to the is it a social construction question. Should I go on to looking for intelligence difference?
No, because I want to talk about the nitty-gritty of this. Now, again, I refer people for a really nuanced review of the current state of the evidence. I refer people to read Nicholas McIntosh's second edition of IQ and Human Intelligence. He has a whole chapter on this. And I will say in a nutshell, after reviewing carefully all the evidence, there is no good evidence that genes whatsoever play a role in explaining differences between blacks and whites. The perspective I'm coming from is, you know, education is such a crucial gateway to opportunities in life. When I see the evidence that blacks and whites differ on average in educational attainment, standardized test scores, things like this, I immediately go into like intervention mode. Like, I want to know, like, what are the whole causal factors? What are the things we can do to change the culture, perhaps in some ways, to motivate, show people who are in low SES environments or those who are in difficult circumstances that there's a future for them? And all these factors have been shown to help reduce the gap. Little by little, lots of little factors add up. Now, the question is, even if they don't all add up 100% to explain the differences, I have this so what question. And Charles Murray was recently on the Sam Harris podcast, as you know, and Sam Harris asked him, you know, the so what question. And the only answer Charles Murray had to the purpose of finding out, detaining the genetic information, was implications for college entrance, for, you know, and I don't feel like I understood whatsoever. I still left that podcast not understanding the so what question. Can you convince me at all that there's any practically meaningful societal value other than just knowledge for the sake of knowledge of knowing that even like 5% of the differences between different groups can be not 100% deterministic, but are influenced by gene differences?
Well, I have complicated feelings about this. I'm not one who would think that there's ever a valid scientific reality out there that we shouldn't go to because the consequences are bad and we don't see the utility. I mean, and in addition, as a practical matter, I think it's generally impossible to keep those genies in the bottle anyway. And if it's true and real, sooner or later it's going to out and everybody's going to know it anyway. So, and I guess I do think that for something that is on a sound theoretical footing and has real meaning and it's true, we should go there. And so I actually don't like the defense against genetically based race differences, which says this is a bad thing. There nothing good can come of it. Why should we know it? I mean, if it were true and if it made sense, and I don't think it makes sense, it's going to happen anyway.
By the way, I agree. I don't think that knowledge should be censored. And I encourage more research on whatever someone wants to research. So I want to be very clear about that. My question, the so what question I'm asking is not the so what in terms of like we shouldn't be doing the research. It's like, you know, the so what is like, I've been asking so what a lot today, like when we talked about the fact that IQ might be heritable. Well, how does that help me as an individual think about what is possible within me? So my question is, people act as though it'd be so forbidden if we found that some small proportion of race differences was correlated with genetic differences. But I'm trying to say is, even if we, gosh forbid, found that, would that change?
Well, I think it would be really bad, frankly.
Tell me more.
Because what would it, I mean, again, I ultimately don't think this concept of genetically based differences between groups makes any sense. And it makes me nervous about talking about the consequences as though it did make sense. But if we really knew that an entire group, the only thing I can imagine that meaning, that statement meaning, is that this group of people has lower IQ than that group of people, and there's nothing you can do about it.
That's not what that would mean, right?
Well, I think it would. If it doesn't mean that, then what sense does it make to say that the mean difference is based in the genes, right? If you can make it go away environmentally, then it wasn't based in the genes in the first place. We really don't know that because of the genes an individual has, that there's a limitation to what their IQ could be under any possible environment that we could expose them to. We don't know that, short of them having some major genetic disorder or something. And actually, I think that's a very important idea, that it's very important that we know basically absolutely nothing about the biology of why some people are smarter than others from a genetic point of view, because that really means that as a matter of potential, our malleability is practically unlimited. And it brings us back to your original point that knowing that intelligence is heritable does not put a limit on the malleability of that intelligence, right? So if what you said is true, that the heritability of IQ is independent of the malleability of IQ, it's not the case that printing out my genome when I was born gives you information that allows you to say that it's impossible that the world might have turned me into a Nobel Prize winner much smarter than I actually am. And what we know about group differences in intelligence is that the magnitude of them is smaller than we absolutely know the malleability of intelligence to be in a number of ways. That when children are adopted out of poor homes into well-off homes, the amount of change in their IQs is larger than the modern difference between blacks and whites. The difference in the average IQ of white people in the United States now and white people in the United States in 1950 is larger than the difference between blacks and whites. So that we know that average IQs are malleable well within the range of that difference. So knowing that, I simply don't see how it makes sense. And, you know, and when you were talking before about mightn't it turn out, well, there's just a few percent, just 5%, the whole percent thing, which is problematic enough at the individual level,
right,
makes no sense at all at the group level. There is no group heritability coefficient that can come out to be equal to a particular number. If you go look at the articles by the people who really believe in genetic differences between the races and in their own way take a very scholarly and serious approach to the problem, it's not like they're listing studies and saying this one shows that it's 12% heritable and this one shows that it's 28% heritable, because there's no mathematical model to produce those numbers. The idea of the group difference being X percent heritable doesn't make sense in terms, there's no quantitative genetics that produces those numbers. One more, and then I'll stop, because I think this is the key important idea. You know, if it made sense that groups might differ in complex behavior, that the groups might differ in complex behavior in a way that's partially in some percentage, wouldn't it be the case that there were other group differences in behavior that we'd already figured out? You know, that Japanese people are more introverted than people from the Dominican Republic. Oh, yes, and we've done some research, and it turns out that's genetic. On the other hand, you know, Chinese people are better table tennis players than people from Kenya. And hey, how do you like that? We did the research, and that turns out to be environmental, right? There's not a single complex human trait that has ever been shown to be genetic or environmental in any proportion, because to me, it's not really an empirical question. The empirical question is, how malleable are these things? And to the extent we know they're malleable, and things are way more malleable than we think, to the extent they're malleable, we can't prove that they're fixed genetically.
Eric, I love that point. I want to end on the point that the idea of how malleable things is a separate issue. I think that's a theme of this whole discussion today. Separate issue from what's the heritability explanation. Good. And I want to leave for the last 30 seconds on a very personal note. I don't want to belabor it, but I would be remiss not to say that I personally saw what it was like to grow up with people expecting very low things from you because of your IQ score. Because of a learning disability, an auditory learning disability, I had a very low measured IQ. And that really, I was labeled a slow learner. And it really did affect how people looked at me and treated me. And then it affected my own self-esteem and then what I did. And it took a couple people to really believe in me and kind of look past the labels before I was inspired to see what I was capable of achieving. So I want to just say that some of these researchers might want to spend some time digging more into different perspectives.
Mm-hmm. Well, I look forward to reading your book. It looks fascinating.
Thank you so much for such an interesting chat today.
Okay, good. That was a pleasure. Thanks very much.
Thank you for the chat. Have a good day.
Okay, yep. I'll be in touch. Bye-bye. Bye.
Thanks for listening to the Psychology Podcast with Dr. Scott Barry-Kaufman. I hope you found this episode just as thought-provoking and interesting as I did. If you'd like to read the show notes for this episode or hear past episodes, you can visit thepsychologypodcast.com.